Thank you all for attending our webinar today on mobile home park investing with your IRA. My name is Jacob Martini with the NTrust Group, and I'll be your host today. Brad, if you could start up the next slide, please. Before we get started, I do just need to give a brief disclaimer that the NTrust Group does not provide investment advice or endorse any specific products, and any and all information and materials presented today are for educational purposes only. All parties are encouraged to consult with their attorneys, accountants, and financial advisors before entering into any type of investment. Here is a short bullet list of what we'll be covering today. And at the end of the presentation, there will be a Q&A session. So you'll be able to answer to en enter in questions during the presentation about content that you believe is interesting or you'd like more detail about. And we will cover that at the end of today's presentation. As a brief introduction for myself, my name is Jacob Marchini. I've been with the NTrust Group for just shy of 10 years, and I have my Bankers Association of America CISP certification, that is Certified IRA Services Professional. Some information about the NTrust Group for those of you who are joining us for the first time today. We are self-directed IRA custodians and administrators. We keep records of your IRA accounts and allow you to make investments in what we call alternative assets like mobile homes. Many of our staff are knowledgeable with CISP certifications, the same ones that I have, and we host monthly educational webinars for the benefit of our clients so they can get the most out of their IRA accounts with us. And some stats here. We have about $5 billion of assets under administration across 24,000 active clients. We have a long history in the business. Since 1980, 40 plus years of service in this space, and we pride ourselves on our single point of contact model for providing client service. Right. And so, without further ado, I'd like to turn things over to our presenters, Mr. Ian Fisher and Brad Johnson.
Thanks, Jake. Really appreciate it. And thank you all for attending. We're going to talk about mobile home parks today and why it might be a good idea for you to invest in this asset class in your IRA. And the subtitle here is just some context of our experience in the space. I've been investing for 12 years now, and we've done over $100 million into the asset class. And so we've seen a few things. We'd like to share some of those lessons with you today. All right, for some more context, here's just a little bit of a broader viewpoint on our portfolio and our track record, 4,000 pads invested in. And as you can see on the right here, we have some of those deals, including the refinance date or sale year. And I always like to focus on the fact that, you know, most of these deals we intend to hold for the very long term. And that is an extremely valuable thing, I think, in the private markets where most investment asset classes, it seems like, have a 2 to 5 year type of hold period, and then you're left with the drag of the paying the taxes and then going out and finding another deal. Whereas vintage is really set up for the long term. As you can see, we've done a fair amount of refinancing of these assets, and once we have our capital back, we continue to collect the cash flow. And that's one of the things we love about this asset class is the ability to do that and hold these investments long term. Some further context on vintage, our leadership team. You have Brad and Ian is listening in case we have a connection problem. But my background kind of touched on 12 years investing in mobile home parks. We have focused on that niche. It's our primary asset class at Vintage, but we also do other things within the private markets. We look for generally investments that we think have an interesting risk reward set up to them. And certainly we're going to get in that today with mobile home parks. Prior to investing in this asset class, I worked in real estate investment banking, and also worked in private equity doing direct deals in just about every asset class, office, apartments, self-storage, and really decided that, hey, once I wanted to go out on my own, I was looking for an asset class that I thought had unique risk reward formula to it, and that's why we chose mobile home parks. All right, so for some context, before we get into the actual details of investing in this space, I'd like to start with, hey, what is investing in a mobile home park? Because most of the time when people hear it, they think trailer park, right? They think the kind of the worst case scenario of what a mobile home park could be. We tend to not invest in those types of properties, right? We are investing on the higher end of this scale from 2 to 5 here. The spectrum is really 1 to 5. 1 is completely scary. You wouldn't want to be driving through at night. Level 2 here is a lot of deferred maintenance. It looks like, you know, a bit of a trailer park, older homes, rough around the edges, rough tenant base, maybe in a very subpar market. And so the idea here is that we are trying to, if we do invest in a 2.5 or a 3-star park, the idea is to gently and methodically move it up in class, because then we're getting a higher multiple when we go to refinance it, or if we do decide to exit, which, you know, is not our preference. But if we do, you want to be able to move it up an asset class because you get better pricing and you get better loan terms, and you increase the number of lenders that will also lend on that asset. So you're increasing the liquidity, so to speak, of that product, of that real estate property. And so you can see kind of level 3, you know, perfectly nice looking community, affordable housing, family oriented, space for somebody to park their car. They can have their little yard. They may or may not have a driveway. And then all the way at the upper end is a level 5, which starts to look like a subdivision. This can be a retirement community in Miami that looks like, you know, a beautiful property on the water, right? That is a level 5. We tend to not invest in too many of those just because they don't generate very high returns. Those are more like 9% return type of profile deals because they're lower risk, and there's just a lot of institutional players that want to own those asset classes. Therefore, we tend to specialize in level 3 and sometimes 4. And then occasionally we'll see a level 2 that you can upgrade with a lot of capital to improve the property, to increase the housing stock, to provide affordable, safe housing to all the tenants there. And you get paid for doing all that work. So that hopefully gives you some context of what we're talking about when we're investing in mobile home parks. And here's one of our investments that we've made. This is in Montana. As you could see, extremely nice looking community. You know, almost looks like a subdivision. It's just there's manufactured homes in them as opposed to stick built. Here's a 3-star park in North Carolina that we've invested in. Once again, perfectly safe, nice looking community. Not as nice as the Montana deal, but this is kind of a bread and butter type of investment that can generate great returns with, we feel, lower risk and provide safe, affordable housing to the tenants. Okay, so why does this opportunity in this asset class for great returns and lower risk, as we've suggested here many, many times already, why does this exist? It's the affordability gap. We have a crisis in the country in housing. I think most of you on the call probably are aware of that. And it's especially painful for the lower end of the market when they're trying to just make all their bill payments and make ends meet when housing is 50% of their monthly budget. And so the ability to offer a safe, clean, and extremely affordable product for a giant percentage of the country is a great opportunity, and was the main reason why this opportunity exists. So 57% of Americans say they live paycheck to paycheck. Obviously, that's a problem. If that's your situation, it almost feels overwhelming each week just trying to get by. And a very looming problem is the fact that most Americans have little to no retirement savings, and Americans are likely going to be living longer with the advent of technology as AI improves medicine. And so we're going to have more and more people retiring, and they're going to be earning fewer and fewer dollars, and they have just about no savings and are 100% reliant on Social Security and social programs. So that's not a great recipe. And then on top of that, we have maybe 3 to 5 million homes shortage, a housing shortage in this country, depending on whose stats you believe. And so that problem keeps compounding, and interest rates aren't helping. So what does mobile home parks do? It helps on the bottom end of that housing spectrum, where we can come in with the lowest cost provider and see almost unlimited demand when you have so many people looking for an affordable solution. Here's just the breakdown of the cost of a new mobile home relative to a stick-built home. These are new homes, once again. So a brand new mobile home might cost $120,000. And so here we have somebody paying in cash in the first column for a mobile home, and their monthly cost to maintain that home and pay for lot rent might be $850 on average, whereas the stick-built home in the second column, average new home is $500,000. And so it costs $100,000 just for 20% down. So you've almost spent the entire amount to buy the mobile home outright in just your 20% down payment. And then, of course, your monthly cost to service that loan are quite high. And so the delta there is almost 70% on a monthly ongoing basis. And so that's really the main reason there's so much demand. And so we don't need to worry about demand in our industry. It's really worrying about the infrastructure and the markets that you're going into. Any market you go into to invest in a mobile home park is almost guaranteed that demand is going to be through the roof. And so we really focus on trying to make sure that that market has sufficient incomes and the population is stable, because we know the demand is going to be there. Because, you know, this industry was really founded on this principle of being able to extend your retirement by selling your stick-built home and then going into a mobile home park community and buying a home outright in cash, and therefore reducing your monthly allowance to housing, so to speak, your monthly expenditures to housing. So that's how this industry started. It got away from that for a long time, but still plenty of people view transitioning into a mobile home park as a retirement strategy because they don't have enough saved up to live for 30 years without any income other than Social Security. And so this is what we focus on, you know, affordable, respectable, and professional communities that we want to provide a great product to the tenants, and they will take care of us. We take care of the property, they take care of us, everybody wins. Last slide on this affordability gap is just thinking about the construction. What are we dealing with? We're dealing with a manufactured home that is much more affordable because it is created in a factory with a controlled environment. We don't have to deal with weather delays, right? The manufacturers can crank these out and can buy materials in bulk, and they don't have as many labor problems. They don't have to deal with going back to the hardware store to go grab some tool they forgot or material they ran out of. Everything is very controlled. And so you can deliver a home at about $1 a foot versus $2 a foot in the comparable rental option here. And that translates to even more size. So it's you're the tenants in a bigger home, and yet they're at a cheaper price. And most of the people that are on this call today are lucky enough to not have to think about these things. But if you have the ability to, or you have the options of, hey, I can't spend more than $1,400 a month all in on all of my housing costs, and you're probably going to have to go to an apartment. You're going to have people above and on all sides of you. Whereas a lot of families in this country do not want that. They do not want to be in a Class B apartment building. They want space for their children. They want space for their animals, their pets. They spent most of their life in a stick-built home and love driving up to their own garage and having a controlled parking spot. And they don't want to transition then and downsize into an apartment. So while the people on this call are probably lucky enough to not have to consider a mobile home park, the vast majority of the country views it as a great, valuable product where they can extend their retirement. All right, now let's talk about, we've talked about demand. So let's talk about the structural advantages of this asset class. So unlimited demand coupled with constrained supply. What do I mean by that? Well, it's difficult to get these things built. It's extremely difficult to get a new mobile home park entitled and through construction and infill, which is actually bringing in the homes and selling them outright to the tenants, right? Because the tenants own the home for the most part, on 80%, 85% of the deals that we look at, the tenant is owning the home, right? We own the infrastructure and the land. So we're going to get into supply in a second, but that's the first point on the structural advantages of this asset class. Number two, we talked about. Number three, recession resistant, right? This asset class has performed incredibly well through not only the great financial crisis, but also through COVID and even the 2022, 2023, the pullback we saw in apartment buildings and office and real estate in general did not hit manufactured housing like it did those other asset classes. And the last point here is on the capital structure of this asset class. And that just means, hey, we own the land. Land doesn't need a lot of ongoing capital needs once we've come in and improved things. And so the ongoing capital requirements are far less in this asset class than they might be in something like office or even in multifamily, where there's just a structure that you have to maintain. Once again, we own the land, the tenant owns the home. So we're not getting in the fixing toilets and appliances or even changing out carpet business. All right. So talking about the supply-demand structural advantage here, the reason why it's so stable is because, once again, high demand and no new supply. And because there's no new supply, the tenants tend to not leave, right? Because they own the home versus a renter in an apartment building, which can leave after a year, right? But if you own the home and it costs quite a bit of money to move that home, you're committed to the property. You're invested in that community. You don't view it as some temporary thing. That is your home. You're going to be there a long time. And oftentimes, even if the tenant decides they want to move, it's rare that they pick up the home and leave it and move it out of the park. Usually what happens is they sell it to a friend, a cousin, somebody in the community, another neighbor in that city, and you start receiving new checks from a different name. So the turnover is quite low, right? Apartment buildings, often 50% every year of your rent roll is swapping out, whereas mobile home parks, it's minuscule. It's less than 3% each year, according to all the major operators in this space, of those homes are actually leaving any year. So the stability of your rent roll and your income stream is quite high because of that. That creates this pricing power dynamic that the key here is not taking advantage of that. The key is being able to increase lot rents methodically over time, which is what makes this such a long duration, long-term great asset class suitable for a IRA, is because we can consistently increase lot rents without having to gouge anybody. We consistently increase lot rents over time once they get to market, which generates a lot of great income year in and year out. And I don't know of any other asset class within real estate where you can say that. With apartment buildings, like look at Austin right now. Austin, which was the sweetheart of the real estate world 3 years ago, has gone the last 2 years of negative rent growth, really negative rent growth. That is a function not of demand, that's a function of all the new supply that came into that market. Which, look, I'm a big, proponent of, we need to be building more housing in this country. I wish they would approve some more, mobile home parks that are newer and nicer, that we can increase the housing stock in this country. But it just doesn't happen. Cities, counties don't want to do it, and so therefore we have this ability to consistently raise lot rents. 5% is pretty standard across all the large players, year in and year out, which creates a great predictable income stream, or almost like a dividend growth stock, because a lot of our expenses are fixed, right? They're not growing as high as that 5% lot rent increase. And then we get to put on attractive leverage on top of that, which boosts that cash flow yield even further. And then, so in the bottom graph here is the CapEx. That's the capital expenditures that you have to spend in this asset class relative to some other ones. And as you can see, it's lower. This is data from Green Street and the two major publicly traded REITs in this space. So once again, we're investing in the land or the land infrastructure, the pipes, the roads, the driveways, but there's no structure. We're not having to redo the boiler room. We're not having to redo the lobby of the office building or the roofs of all the apartment buildings. And so just to maintain the buildings, it's a lower percentage of our rent and our revenue each year. That's not to say that the first year we don't spend a fair amount of capital to improve the properties. That's one of our favorite things to do, is to come in and do a splash type of a big spend on capital to improve the roads, to help increase the appearance of some of the homes, maybe add an amenity or two. Spend some real capital to show that we're investing in that community and we want the tenants to stay there long term. Recession resistance. This graph shows every other real estate asset class and its sensitivity to changes in the economy, right? A 1% change in GDP. How does the revenue change, the operating leverage change in each of these asset classes? Intuitively, it makes sense. Hotels on the left-hand side of this graph, right? You have a downturn, you have a big recession, hotels crater in revenue because business travel just falls off a cliff. Mobile home parks on the exact opposite of that spectrum. Everybody needs housing. Everybody really needs affordable housing. And it just is not that impacted by changes in the economy. That's because we are offering the lowest cost housing option, right? It's the last stop on the affordable housing train. So therefore, everybody has to live. The home rent, the lot rent is not that high relative to a lot of these other asset classes as the component of the tenant's overall budget, and therefore they continue to pay the lot rent month in and month out. This is a lot of numbers, but this is just some of the data to back up what we just showed you in concept on the last slide. This is showing the historical NOI, net operating income growth of each of these asset classes. And it's highlighting here in pink mobile home parks relative to all the other ones. And you can see the two most recent downturns. We had the great financial crisis in 08, 09, right? Mobile home parks are still generating positive net operating income, positive growth, which is quite remarkable considering just about everything else was negative over those 2 years. And we saw the same thing during COVID, right? This is the stability of this asset class that we want to hammer this point home, which is why it's so appropriate, I think, for somebody who's thinking in 20, 30-year increments, the ability to put some money to work and just let that cash flow keep coming in, let the returns keep compounding, because it has such a reliable income stream relative to other options in the marketplace. Oh, we went backwards. All right, so let's talk about a couple just example deals, just to give you more context on what this asset class is like, how we think about deals, and maybe you can apply that to your own investment research if you decide to invest in the space on your own or with us or another operator. So this deal is just outside of Raleigh. It's in the Raleigh MSA. It's a portfolio of deals. The park, it's 5-park portfolio, 237 lots. This is the picture on the bottom right, is the largest of the 5 parks. And as you can see, it's just a country type of environment. It really suits somebody that doesn't want to live in an apartment in the middle of the city. They want some space. They want room for parking. They want that country style, lifestyle. And this deal is actually one of our hairier deals from just a business model or business plan standpoint. That park-owned home number here, 107, this is one of the rare deals where a large percentage of the homes in this portfolio are actually owned by the park. Now, that is a strategy, and it's particularly effective in the Southeast, where you can come in as an operator. You get a discount on a property like this because most buyers of parks don't want to be in the home space because of all the things we talked about. So the business plan here is to get those 107 homes off of the balance sheet, right? We purchased or we invested in this deal with our partner there in Raleigh about, I want to say 7 months ago. And there are already 40 homes through that process. So we're down to more like 70 homes that are park owned. And hopefully in the next couple of years, we'll be down to zero, which once again, increases the amount of buyers that will look at this, that will purchase and will pay a higher multiple, increases the type of lenders that will lend on this deal, including Fannie and Freddie, which are the largest lenders in multifamily and in manufactured housing. And those lenders love this space because of all the things that we've talked about. It's lower risk than what they're typically investing in. And so great debt still though, at a 4.5 interest only. We want to conserve capital because we want to reinvest back into the turnaround of this portfolio. We don't want to pay principal for the first 5 years on this one. And you can see the loan to value of less than 50%. A lot of people are comfortable investing at 70%, 75% in real estate. This is a lower risk deal from just a leverage standpoint, which we tend to like and think is a great opportunity right now. It's harder to finance just about any deal, which makes these type of properties prime candidates for coming in, implementing the business plan, gradually increasing lot rents, and then going ahead with a refinance in 3 years, as we kind of showed you our track record of how many refinancings we've done, where you pull out all of your capital and you go and you make that a new investment, right? And so you can keep generating some cash flow for that prior investment, keep benefiting from the appreciation long-term, but then compound your capital by going out and buying more assets. And now you've decreased the overall risk profile of your portfolio by doing that. And the last point on this one is just kind of showing you the how under market lot rent this portfolio was relative to the other housing options in this market, right? Most people who are looking to try to get a 3-bedroom home or 2-bedroom apartment are spending a lot more than the current tenants of this mobile home park and just paying lot rent. And so the key here is to gently increase that, you know, over time. We don't try to do it the first year, right? These people have been getting an outstanding deal by living in this community with that low of lot rent, but that's just not keeping up with inflation and that's not keeping up with the marketplace. So gradually we got to get it up to market over time, but that shows you the amount of margin of error that we have and the amount of growth runway to go ahead and keep increasing cash flows. And here's just some more pictures of this property just to give you a better feel of what it looks like. Second deal, this is the park in Helena. We showed you a picture at the beginning of this presentation, but this is one of the nicest parks we've ever invested in, just to kind of show you the upper end of the spectrum of what's out there. These are hard to find, but they are out there, and they are oftentimes are owned by a mom and pop operator that maybe their dad developed the deal. The parents developed the property 30, 50 years ago. That's been passed to them. And they are like, wait, I got a mobile home park. I don't really know what I want to do with this. I'm a doctor, a lawyer, whatever. I've moved on, started my own career. So I'm open to selling it now. So we see mom and pop sellers quite often in this space. It's a real opportunity to come in with institutional capital, professional property management, increase the housing stock, swap out older homes that are dilapidated with new homes. And a lot of mom and pop operators don't have that capital to do all those things. They don't have a professional real estate team that can run the property and do all of these things. They've just been benefiting from the dynamics that we've talked about at this space for so long, and it's been their only source of income, so they don't reinvest back into the properties. And that's a real opportunity in this sector as it becomes more consolidated. In other words, more professional owners start buying mobile home parks and implement professional standards and property management systems. So this one has one park-owned home. It's got city utilities with a well on one section of the main property, but it's got a backup connection to the city. We focus a lot on utilities in this space, which I certainly encourage you to as well if you're looking at a new deal, because because we're offering infrastructure. That's what we are providing to these tenants, so that they can put their home on the property and connect to the utilities. So you almost have to think of yourself as a utility provider, right? We're providing access, a concrete pad, connections to water, sewer, connections to electric, right? And so you want to make sure that the infrastructure is in good shape and you're not taking outsized risk by going with some hairier private utilities that we can talk about. Some private utilities are fine, others not so much. Here's a case study of a full cycle investment, just to give you a sense of what it can look like when the business plan is fully been executed and you decide to leave the deal. This one was in Wisconsin, right next to a Walmart. Actually, you can see in the upper left-hand picture, which ended up being a great amenity for the tenants at this park. They could just walk to go do their grocery shopping, which is huge for moms in this park, at least it was. And this deal, this was, sorry, one last point on this deal. This one had a lot of RVs that were in the park that we were able to get a discount on the purchase of this asset class because RVs can leave in the middle of the night, right? They can unhook from the utilities and just drive out of the park. So obviously you don't want to pay as high a price for a park that has a ton of RVs in it. And so part of the business plan here, which was one of our favorite strategies, is over time gradually replacing RVs with either small mobile homes or regular full mobile homes, because you're going to be able to sell that property or just generate a lot more reliable cash flow over time. And so that was the big value add. Okay, so what about red flags? So I've broken it out here into red flags at the property level and red flags at the sponsor level. So the sponsor is the operator, somebody you might be entrusting your capital with. I think both of these are equally important, and arguably the sponsors could be more important. At the property level, your risks are really thinking about, as we talked about, the infrastructure. There's just like the quality of the mobile home parks, there's a spectrum when it comes to infrastructure. City water and city sewer, you're connected to the city utilities, that is the preference. Direct build connections, where the city is actually billing the tenants directly for their usage of water and direct bill electric, that is the dream. Because as you imagine, if you're not having to deal with that billing, you're not dealing with any losses from people not paying for their water bill. So that's the dream. That's one end of the spectrum. The other end of the spectrum is extremely gnarly private utilities. And we're talking like things that you wouldn't even want to, you know, walk by, like a lagoon, a packaging plant, septic's okay. I mean, generally, if you have space, right? Septic's is pretty common in the Southeast and Midwest. And as long as you have space, it's a large acreage for that project, that's fine. But that's in well water is obviously private water. So that's the other end of the spectrum. You got to be very careful with doing deals with operators that don't have a lot of experience with those private utilities. It's not to say never do those, but packaging plant in well or lagoon in well would be probably no-gos for your first deal. I certainly wouldn't recommend it, whether or not you're purchasing one or investing in one. You might want it. That's advanced level type of investing. We almost always pass on those types of deals. We kind of like the middle spectrum area of some private utilities like septic, maybe well, but certainly prefer city water, city sewer. All right, number two, fuzzy accounting. So when you're buying from mom and pop, oftentimes the financials and are not going to be super sophisticated. You're not going to get a war room in Dropbox of perfectly organized due diligence files. You're going to get sometimes literally a shoebox of receipts and invoices and documentation that you're going to have to sit through. So fuzzy accounting can be tough here, because sometimes owners will try to goose the books. They're going to try to cook the books by, they know they're selling it, so they're going to try to artificially boost cash flow the year prior to them selling it. And so you just kind of, find these red flags by getting in the weeds, getting somebody who has a forensic accounting type of approach to actually go through all the statements and then tie that to the profit and loss and balance sheet. And so this is just something to be aware of And something to be asking sponsors that you might want to invest with is how they do this due diligence and make sure that the revenue stream that they are paying for, because you're paying a multiple of the revenue stream, to make sure that that is actually real cash flow. Non-conforming zoning issues, grandfathered in is fine as long as the city's not going to actively fight you if you try to replace a home or move in a new home into a vacant pad. Sometimes those vacant pads will just sit vacant for a while if you as the park owner are not actively going out, purchase a home, bring it in, and then sell it to an interested tenant. That's a much more common way and a much faster way to fill that vacant lot and than just waiting for somebody to move a home in, right? So you want to make sure that you can do that. And that's through going through the due diligence process with a consultant that is checking zoning issues. And then the last one here on the property level, it would be a high percentage of park-owned homes in a soft market. Now, we showed you a deal that had a high percentage of park-owned homes, right, in the Raleigh MSA, but that's a very strong market, right? Raleigh is booming. What you wouldn't want to do is do a property like that in a declining, you know, rust belt, the factory, the major employer, you know, left 5 years ago, and the population is steadily declining and incomes aren't there. You would want to avoid a type of park like that, like the plague, because the cash flow and the returns probably look pretty compelling, right, on paper. But what you don't realize is that one's going to slowly bleed cash and you're going to circle the drain on a property like that, most likely because the park-owned homes, if there's not a lot of demand for, and there's not a lot of income to support the higher cost of park-owned homes and the higher maintenance requirements, you're constantly going to be injecting new capital into that park just to kind of maintain status quo, maintain occupancy. And it's going to feel like pouring water into a bucket with a hole in it, right? So that's a big one for red flags at the property level. A lot of park homes in a soft market. Strong market, it's actually an opportunity because you can methodically go through. And as we talked about, if you have a big team, if you have a home sales team, you have maintenance crews, rehab crews, if you're vertically integrated, an operator can actually go into a park like that and get those homes off the balance sheet, increase the liquidity, increase the return profile of that asset. All right, at the sponsor level, what are some red flags? Well, we have a very small team trying to do this from 3,000 miles away. Now, I sympathize with new operators in this space who are just getting in, because 12 years ago, I was that person. I was two guys and a pitch deck and some dreams. And you know, I certainly sympathize that, but your first mobile home park investment with retirement money is probably not the type of capital you want to take experiments and let somebody experiment and learn on your dime. So we certainly recommend going with established sponsors that have at least a regional presence. Maybe they have 3-5 parks in one particular market if their operations and team is not nearby. But what you just don't want is just somebody who's telling you, hey, I live in California and we're buying this deal in Indiana or upstate New York, and I'm going to be there every month. I'm going to be there overseeing all the improvements we need to make, because it's just not going to happen unless they're just a freak of nature and don't have family that they want to spend a lot of time with. It's hard to fly out to these assets quite frequently. And I know because I've done it, right? So you want to have a team or a focus regionally where you have a lot of staff that can get out to the properties, oversee things, at least check in on the asset once a month, have structured calls with the on-site team, the maintenance people, the property manager, and just have the resources to be able to oversee an asset properly. Because this is kind of like the broken window theory in New York, right? Once you start letting little things slide at a property because you're not paying attention to it, then all of a sudden the tenants start letting their rent slide. Yeah, it's like these guys are asleep at the wheel. We're going to maybe like leave that trash out, leave the car, you know, that's not working on the driveway, or, you know, whatever. Like we're not going to paint our home this year because these guys don't care about the roads. So you just have to make sure that there's resources, both in terms of manpower, systems, and also capital to properly maintain these things. All right, no limited track record kind of ties in with the first point, but the track record you know, part is just once again, you want to be able to see that this team has seen things in this industry. It's not a mailbox money type of industry. If you're the operator, certainly can be as an LP, right? That's the whole point of being a limited partner, is that you don't do the hard work. You collect the checks. You've taken the risk in letting your precious capital be invested with a sponsor. And so you get to the benefit of the passive income. The operators, that's the active. They got to be boots on the ground. And you want to ideally work with a team that has seen a large spectrum of variables in this industry, because there's a bunch of surprises. There's a ton of things, countless things that came up in that 12 years that I didn't know, right, going into this asset class. Limited property management systems. Yeah, you can get at these red flags when you're just kind of asking basic questions on how they're running their portfolio, how their property management team is assembled. How do they process evictions? What kind of software are they using? Like you can fill this out pretty quickly and figure it out if they're just kind of, you know, doing this thing part-time on an Excel spreadsheet, or if they actually have put a real operating platform in place to manage these assets, because they do require a lot of handholding. And so you want somebody on the team that you're investing with to have an engineering mindset, a property management mindset, where they want to dial these systems and they want to do things in a repeatable fashion month in and month out with their team and their systems, because then it becomes way more predictable, which is what we want in this space. We don't invest in this space to get 10x in 5 years. We invest in this space to get repeatable, recurring income. All right, aggressive underwriting assumptions. This is the last red flag, and we're winding down here on the speech portion of our presentation, but this is the last red flag for the sponsor level, which is aggressive modeling, right? The Excel spreadsheet, you can make the numbers say whatever you want, right? So if you start seeing things like less than 35% operating expenses, right? The load, the expense load, the percentage of expenses relative to the revenue, if that is sub 35%, doesn't mean that it's a deal killer. It just means, oh, well, you should ask some questions about that, because maybe the water, the utilities are direct billed, and therefore that property could support that low expenses relative to the purchase price. But maybe the sponsor is just being aggressive with not estimating the property tax reassessment correctly. Maybe they're being just too cheap with the amount of the people that they want to hire, because you can't run a $10 million asset, even a $5 million asset, with somebody that you're paying $15,000 a year who lives at the property. You need to pay for professional management in order to take care of these things. So those are just an operating red flag. Fast infill rate, home sales. If they have a track record of doing this, of working on hairier deals that have a high percentage of park-owned homes, or even worse, or have a high percentage of vacancy, like 50% vacancy, that's a very difficult deal. You can make a lot of money on those deals, but they require a ton of capital. And like we talked about, a vertically integrated team, home infill, home maintenance, home sales. So you need to have a lot of resources and capital and talent to pull that off. And so if you see somebody that doesn't have a track record in doing those types of deals, and yet they're assuming they're going to bring in 20 homes a month, I would question that. It actually is quite difficult to sell homes quickly. A lot of paperwork involved. It's just like selling a stick-built home, you know, but slightly easier. But there's still a ton of work that needs to be done to get somebody to buy a mobile home, just like there is to get somebody to buy a stick-built home. All right, and then the last point here is a zero CapEx capital improvement budget or capital reserves. So we mentioned that the CapEx is lower in this space relative to just about every other real estate asset class, but not that first year. If you're improving the park, if part of your business plan is to improve the quality of the park in order to help justify some of the lot rent increases, or just to, you know, ongoing capital reserves to deal with surprises as they come up. Pipes break, pipes burst, roads degrade if they're asphalt, right? If they're concrete, probably not. But if they're asphalt or something less, right, you're going to be spending money on pothole repairs. And so the groups that try to do this on a shoestring budget, anybody who says cash cow, right, when talking about mobile home parks, that's a red flag. That worked maybe 10 years ago when you can buy these things for, you know, 8% cap rates, huge discounts, and you had a giant margin of error to not be very good at operations and not have to reinvest in the property and still support your loan. Now, this is big boy. This is like the pro market, where you have to have like real systems, teams, capital in place to run these things, and you can't do it on, you know, a shoestring. And so the groups that try to treat these things as cash machines and not reinvest back into the property are doing the property a disservice. They're doing their investors a disservice, and the industry at whole. Like, this industry needs to continue to advance, become more professional, and that requires, you know, capital, especially that first year if you are improving the quality of the operation. All right, and final point before questions here is, you know, why now? Why is this interesting for somebody in their retirement account or just to invest in the space? Well, I think that the asset class has been proven, right? We're battle tested. We've been through a number of pullbacks, and yet it just keeps on trucking, right? So the asset class has proven it's recession resistant, right? We have no idea what the next 30 years are going to look like. If it's going to replicate exactly what's happened the last 30 years, but that's the best indicator we have to make that prediction. And the last 30 years in this space has been unbelievably good. And so we think it's a great time to be putting money to work now, because we're kind of removed a lot of the question marks in this asset class. And we now are investing at a difficult time to be buying these deals. It's not, you can't just get an 80% loan and raise, you know, $500 million on a whim to put money to work in this space. It is harder to get deals done today than it was in 2019, 2021, which means that's usually a better time to be putting money to work. Those deals that we're buying at 50% leverage, where you're having to do a fair amount of structure and you're having to put more capital up, that's actually decreasing your risk going in. And it's setting up this great opportunity to pull out capital within a few years, maybe five, via refinance on a higher net operating income basis, and then redeploy those assets into new productive investments. And so it's hard to be putting new money to work after an industry like real estate has had some trouble, but, you know, mobile home parks didn't have that trouble, like office, like apartment buildings. And yet we're coming in at the right part of the cycle that you want to be deploying capital when it's not super easy. There's not, you know, animal spirits where people are just doing whatever crazy deal at competitive prices that just because they can raise unlimited capital and get unlimited debt. So anyways, that's my speech. Hopefully that was a good overview of the asset class, why it's compelling, and perhaps we should get into some questions. And we'll let Jake take over. I've talked enough.
Thank you very much for the presentation, Brad. So before we proceed direct to the Q and answer session here, we do just have a very brief wrap up for the presentation. Move on to the next slide there. Okay, so for those of you, again, who are just starting with us here at the Entrust Group, who have not gotten an account yet, if you are interested in using your retirement funds to invest in something like a mobile home or other types of alternative assets, getting started in that with the Entrust Group is done in three major steps. First is to fill out an application to open an account with us here at the Entrust Group. Then the next step is to put money into that account from wherever it is currently. So most of you will probably have IRAs, 401ks, or other retirement accounts at other firms like Fidelity, Schwab, Morgan Stanley, etc. And those typically will transfer or roll over easily to your Entrust Group account if you want to exit those types of investments to put money towards real estate, mobile homes, or other types of alternative assets. So once the money is here, we move on to the third step, where you direct us to put money from your IRA into a proposition like what Brad has described here today, or any other type of investment. That's three steps to investing with your Entrust Group IRA. What's next? Now that we've concluded the presentation, at the end of this, we will be sending you a replay for viewing on your own time with additional resources. The follow-up email will include the video, slides, all of that sort of thing for reviewing all this information at your leisure. And we would love it if you would also take the opportunity to sign up for our next webinar for avoiding investing mistakes in 2026 going into the new year. And as always, if you have any more other questions, you can follow up with myself for IRAs or with Brad. Our personal contact information will be available on screen during the Q&A session. And without further ado, we can go ahead and proceed to Q&A. So if you folks have any questions about the material presented today, please feel free to type that into the chat and I will read them off and either answer them myself or turn things over to Brad so that he can provide further information. I want to move forward one more slide there, Brad, so that your information and mine appears on screen. There we go. Got the Q&A. Okay, so here we go. So the first comes from Gene Rosen. If you as a company are not in any hurry to exit an investment in many of these properties, how would I exit an investment if I were to invest with your company? Seems like for you, Brad.
Yeah. So we actually do two strategies. One is our longer term funds that are 10-year holds that we will have the ability to liquidate people that don't want to continue the party, right? That don't want to roll into more time and more deals. And so we have always offered those options in the past to investors. So we get a market view, a broker view of what the assets are worth, and then we can value your shares at that time. We also do singular deals, right, where we have a particular mobile home park investment that we will offer to our investors that like to do one-off deals. And those tend to have anywhere from 5 to 10 year type of holds, where that's in the structure, that's in the terms, that's in the agreement with the operator. And so those are for people that do want to cycle out. And, you know, even with those, we'll often find a way to either 1031 or roll it into a different investment for the people that do want to hold long-term. So it's a case by case situation. I do recommend people that are thinking about this asset class, right? We try to think about, because the upside is fairly compelling, right? We try not to focus on that. We try to focus on how do we, you know, lose money in this deal or in this style of investing. And generally, the way we try to think about that is by doing a lot of deals, right, and diversifying. It's much more common if somebody's going to invest in one singular real estate property, then you're adding more risk into the scenario versus 10, 20 type of properties. It's very hard to completely blow up a fund that's diversified as long as it's not over leveraged. Whereas one deal, you just bring in more variables into the equation. So we tend to recommend people who don't want to be evaluating individual deals, maybe don't have a ton of experience within investment real estate, to invest in a fund style where you're diversified, right? And then there's other fund investors that if you need liquidity, right, they can purchase your shares. The fund sponsors, we can purchase your shares. There's more options in a fund versus a one-off deal. It might be only 5 to 15 people, depending on the size of the deal. So there tends to be a little less liquidity, but the one-off deals, maybe they're only going to be held for 5 to 7 years versus maybe the fund is going to be a longer term investment. So there's not a, you know, here's the exact path on every single deal. It kind of depends on if you're a longer-term investor, or if something comes up, you raise your hand, and we try to help you with exit liquidity.
And a follow-up by the same person, do you pay regular dividends?
Yeah, so in the fund format, we pay monthly dividends, monthly distributions, rather. And in any fund we've ever done, we've never missed a distribution payment. So we, like I said, when you're investing in a portfolio of properties, it's just easier to manage that. And because we might have some that are value add deals where we're injecting some capital up front and we might have some other deals in the fund that are more stabilized, where they're 100% occupied, they're generating a lot of cash flow, and then we're able to use that combination to make the distribution payments. Whereas sometimes if you're investing in one particular property, maybe it's 2-3 years of that renovation or that value add plan where the sponsors are not making distributions because they're focused on turning around the asset. But our funds are not like that. Our funds have a spectrum of deal flow, including stabilized assets that generate cash flow. And so we make monthly distributions.
Okay. Next is looks like a multi-part question here. Ask about what is the investor business structure with Vintage, i.e. limited partnership, DST, TIC, or other, the depreciation and bonus depreciation for investor, ? How long is the hold and exit strategy, ?
Yeah, so that's a lot. Let's try to take those one by one. The structure is LLC. So there's a fund entity, right, that buys the individual assets. So each individual property has its own LLC. You would be, the fund investors invest at the mothership, right? And so that's not a tenant in common or a DST. A DST is for a 1031, right? When you're exchanging property into like-kind real estate, a DST achieves that. That's not what we're doing, right? This is not for 1031s. This is for new investments, new capital. The depreciation side of this business is quite attractive because land infrastructure is most of the value, and that's 15-year property. 15-year property, thanks to the new tax bill, you can bonus 100% in year one. And so, yeah, that can be quite compelling. It's less applicable for retirees, of course. If it's in your retirement account, that bonus depreciation is not that meaningful to you.
He is correct on that, by the way. The sort of things for depreciation oftentimes do not come into play with retirement accounts because the tax benefits of your retirement account come into play first and sort of render the other things moot because it's not affecting your personal tax return.
I think the reason you put this in a retirement account is just something to add a ton of diversification to your overall portfolio, because this income stream, this return stream, does not respond to dips in the stock market, right? It's unlike just about any other investment asset class from a correlation standpoint. So when some things are zigging, right, our mobile home parks just are doing kind of steady, doing their thing, generating methodical growth. At least that's been the historical track record. Obviously, future performance, we'll see. Mm-hmm. But highly likely, given the track record, I would argue. Retirement accounts, I think this asset class is useful just because, I kind of think about it as some of the investments we made, I hope I'm gifting those to my grandchildren at a stepped up basis, because they just are great assets that generate a lot of cash flow. So why would I sell that, right? Then if I sell that, it's great. You get a big outcome, but you got to pay the taxes, and then you got to go find a new one. You got to find a new place to deploy that capital, versus it's just something that's generating cash flow. Oftentimes we refinanced it, so we pulled out our at-risk capital. And so that way it's pretty good for an account that you just kind of want to put to bed from an investment standpoint, at least in my view.
Mm-hmm. And number three, the third part of that, how long is the hold, and four, the exit strategy for Vintage?
Yeah, so the funds, as I mentioned, are 7 to 10 years. We have options to roll that into the new fund if investors want to continue going because they like the cash flow that we've been generating. They like the strategy. But if people do want to exit, we can do that. We can do that by selling some assets. We can do that by valuing the total portfolio from broker opinions of value or getting appraisals, and then exiting people at that time if they want liquidity. It's 7 to 10 years for a fund investment. If you are a professional investor and you want putting a lot of, $100,000 checks, $50,000 checks into individual deals and creating your own portfolio, we do have that ability to do deal by deal. And those tend to be more structured, as in like it's either a 5-year hold, or we're telling you up front that we would love to own this asset indefinitely. And that's all in the deck materials, offering materials for each individual asset.
Next question. Will you give the info to invest with your company? Does your company fund loans on multifamily units, including RV mobile homes? So.
Well, yeah, our info is right here on the page, and you can get our track record. That's probably the most useful piece of information on our website, at vintage-funds.com. The question on financing home, I guess mobile homes or trailers. So I mentioned that if you have a vacant pad at a park, you want to fill that because you want the lot rent, right? You want to be that lot to become productive. Instead of just waiting for your phone to ring and somebody to move in a mobile home, which does happen in great markets, but you oftentimes you'd want to make it happen sooner. So we will front the capital to pay for the home, which is anywhere from 70 to 150,000 is the range of a new home, single wide, double wide. And then we have that productive asset once we sell it. You can rent it if you want to immediately to fill up that day that you move it in. There's unlimited demand for rentals of new homes because they're beautiful. The homes look like stick-built homes inside. You should take a look at these homes from Clayton as an example. Clayton Homes, they're beautiful. They're gorgeous homes. You wouldn't mind putting grandma in plenty parts of this country. So, yeah, we will front capital to increase the value of the property to increase occupancy selectively. Trailers or RVs, we tend not to do that because once again, the RV can leave in the middle of the night. That's more like a 100% RV park is more like a hotel, if you think about it, right? Where your rent roll every night is moving, at least it can. So we don't like to put a big multiple on that revenue stream because we can't predict the future of what it's going to look like. So anyways, that's how we think about RVs versus homes and paying for them.
The next question or the next entry from that same person has their contact information. So, Iris, if you would like to be contacted by Brad or myself, please feel free to forward us your information or any questions you would like after the presentation. Again, our personal contact information here for that sort of thing is on the screen. So we will be happy to answer more questions if you have more questions after the Q&A session. Moving on, though, so on the topic of utilities, do the mobile home owners pay for those as a homeowner, or do they pay you, the landowner? Is that a component of the land rent and annual increases?
So we almost always there's three kind of options really. There's direct build where the tenant has a relationship with the city or the utility provider directly. We don't get involved at all. We literally are just giving them a piece of concrete pad for to put their home on. That's the dream, right? We love those parks. The in the middle option is when there is a master meter utility, a meter at the front of the park, and we are getting billed by the city, and we then are looking and reading ourselves, just like a utility provider, going around looking at everybody's usage for water. Electrical, gas, we almost always avoid those deals, right? We want those to be direct billed. We don't want to get in the electricity game and the gas game, right? But water, sewer, oftentimes you have to be a part of that process if there is a master meter that the city bills off of. And then, you have to factor that into your math because you're not going to collect 100%. There's always going to be some sort of leakage, right? Literally, leakage from water in the pipes and leakage from just a tenant not paying on time their water bill or a misread of the meter, right? Which does happen. And then on the third option, which we usually avoid these deals too, is when there is just a master meter and there's no individual meters at the homes, and you just divide the bills by the current homeowners in the park. That's a kind of a recipe for disaster. You get some weird outcomes there because people are incentivized to just, willy-nilly, take 3 hour showers and, fill up giant swimming pools in their backyard because they are not paying. They're sharing that cost among all their other neighbors. Which is weird, the weird incentive. So you want to get the incentives right. So in those parks, we will come in and we will install sub-meters into each individual home, which is not cheap, but it's completely worth it. So those are the three different options on metering utilities.
Next question is about the demographics on the properties. How about the demographic mix on these properties, the Raleigh one in particular? Can you give us an idea of retired versus working and AGI of those working? Credit scores, aggregate level data is all that's needed. Trying to get an idea of the clientele.
Yeah, so bestplaces.com is actually a great resource for these the demographics on each individual city. But it's a spectrum. Like the Raleigh Park, it's an all-age park, and so an all-age means it's a family orientated versus a retirement community. There we tend to not invest in a lot of retirement communities which are 55 plus. We tend to prefer the family parks because they have more income that's coming in, that's growing, whereas somebody who is a retiree is obviously on more in the fixed income part of their life, and so they can't sustain methodical rent increases unless their Social Security, payments are going up, or they're doing a great job managing their retirement portfolios. So we tend to prefer all age, and so those parks are a spectrum. Yes, you will have 10 to 25% that might be retirees. Maybe they have part-time jobs. But oftentimes it's a younger family. It's a middle income family with two to three kids, one to two jobs in that household. And a lot of times, the range, you want to have a diverse employer base because you don't want that park to be tied to any one industry, ideally, which is why we tend to avoid, a city where it's literally like an oil company maybe employs the whole town. Or the military base employs the whole town. You typically want to spread that out. A lot of healthcare, some tech, right? A lot of government employees is great. Like Kansas City is a randomly great market because the IRS is there. It's like there's a lot of stable jobs in a town like that. So we want to see a lot of universities. Ideally, those job bases are pretty secure, at least for now. So yeah, diverse employee base. It's hard to know exactly what each individual park because we're not interviewing each tenant, but you get a feel for it when you're driving around doing your due diligence on what the makeup, the tenant, composition is of each particular asset.
Next question is, can the structure accommodate 1031 funds? I'd actually like to speak on this from a retirement account point of view and just say that 1031 exchanges typically don't come into play with retirement accounts because the purpose of a 1031 exchange is to avoid taxation on the gains from the sale of a property so that you take the gains that you make from selling a property and put that gain into another property. And so it prevents you from having to pay taxes on the profit from your first sale of that property. And because of if you are investing in a property using your retirement account, using a traditional or Roth IRA, the tax benefits of the money in a traditional IRA is already tax deferred. So you're not using taxable money to make that purchase, and then the gains are already tax deferred without having to do a 1031 exchange. So if you invest in vintage, or if you invest in another property or a mobile home, and then you sell that property, the gains come back to your IRA and are not taxable as long as you keep them in the IRA and don't take a distribution of those funds. So from a standpoint of using your IRA to invest, a 1031 exchange is not really applicable. And if you have proceeds from a 1031 exchange that you've already done, you're not putting those 1031 proceeds into your IRA unless it's only partially as a contribution for the current tax year. So not really applicable from a retirement account point of view. If you have any further questions, any further information to add there, Brad.
Yeah, I would just say, if it's a seven-figure 1031, we have accommodated and helped people out with those size of deals. It's difficult to pull off, right? It's each one's custom. It's not like we can say, hey, come into the fun with your 1031. So it's case by case, but it has been done. We have done it a fair amount of times on a individual basis.
Next question. I have heard that the first thing to look for in mobile home park investments is water infrastructure. Thoughts?
Yes, that's a big one, right? So, well, the nice thing, I like to take risk on infrastructure. I would rather take risk on infrastructure in older park, aging infrastructure that we budget for the likelihood of replacing it versus taking demand risk. I think a lot of people are too comfortable with demand risk in this space, not from just like, hey, I lots of cities in the most of the cities in the country, there's going to be overwhelming demand. The question is, can they pay for it? So I don't want to take a lot of market risk on incomes. I want to take, oh, this is an aging water system with old copper pipes that probably have pinhole leaks. So we're going to be maybe not super efficient on water collection. We're going to have to watch that. But I can quantify that risk usually. You're not going to be dramatically off on your water line replacement budget if you're being thoughtful about underwriting that versus missing on incomes, right? Missing on demand, on the ability for the tenants to pay for a lot rent increase. I don't want to take that kind of risk. I want to take defined risk, and that tends to be infrastructure risk. So yeah, water is important. We have done well. I don't love it, just because it's like, what happens if the well runs dry? Unlikely. There's wells in most of the country, but you ideally want to have a backup, some way, shape, or form to be able to deliver water to that property. Ideally, there's a city connection somewhat close by. It's occasionally we will take that risk if if we feel like we're getting paid for it and it's not completely remote in the middle of nowhere, right? If it's somewhere in a developed market, there's a city water line, close by. So we tend to, want to get city water on most of the deals. But yeah, those are kind of the things we think about when it comes to water infrastructure risk.
Next question. Do you avoid areas with severe weather risk?
Yes and no. So we don't like to do single asset deals in a market that it's like right on the water in Miami, right? Which is too bad because there's beautiful properties in Miami that are extremely valuable, but you are facing catastrophic risk of loss. Now, you can make the argument that if something's that well located, that's right on the water, and you get a giant hurricane that damages half the homes, well, guess what? That place is so valuable, that property is so valuable that over time there's new tenants that will come in, buy new homes on their own dime, and you'll have a full park again. But life's too short, right? That's a lot of stress. So we tend to selectively we'll layer in a deal like we're doing a portfolio in South Carolina and North Carolina with some of our joint venture partners in that market that if it was one deal, my preference would probably be to pass, but it's a portfolio of deals. So, okay, we get extremely unlucky. And despite the fact that nothing weather related has happened to that park in 40, 50 years, we unfortunately, the day after we purchase it, one of the four parks is blown away. At least you feel like it's not a complete loss. You have other asset classes to support it. So, we try to think about this industry once again. How do we mitigate our loss potential, right? How do we focus on not losing money? And that's one of the few ways, you can lose money in this space is getting extremely unlucky on weather or over-leveraging, or making a due diligence mistake. That's kind of where you see people get hurt in the space is kind of not taking care of some of the basic due diligence or taking a little bit too much risk on an individual deal versus a portfolio.
Moving on. In your mobile home parks, do you allow for outside investors to buy homes, act as landlord, and rent those out to a tenant, effectively a sublease?
Yes, to an extent. So there are constraints on the loan documents usually that will cap that. Because they if you just think about it, if you let that's called a Lonnie dealer. It's a weird little name for that business model in the space. If you let a Lonnie dealer take up 5, 10, 15, I've seen parks where it's one person owns 50% of the homes. And the seller will try to tell you that, oh no, there's 100% tenant owned park we don't own any of the homes. Well, yeah, but one person that I have zero control of has 50% control of the homes and the property and, you know, can make life really painful for us. They can stop paying you. They can move homes out. They can, you know, they can create problems with your tenant base by just telling them, the tenants, not to stop paying lot rent because they're trying to get X, Y, Z out of the ownership. So yeah, you want to selectively allow this because they're great at kind of filling one or two, you know, one, maybe even five lots, right? Efficiently. If you don't have a big capital budget, but like once you progress in this industry, if you continue to buy parks, normally you get to the point where you kind of just don't want to deal with it at all. You kind of want your team to control every aspect of operations. So selectively, yes, it is allowed, but not in a meaningful way. And the lenders got smart to that. Why? Because, you know, 15 years ago, 20 years ago, they got burnt on one deal where it was a situation with somebody owned half of the homes and pulled them out of the park. So yeah, it's selectively you can do that.
Next question. Believe this was covered a bit earlier, but would we be investing in a fund or in a specific deal in a specific location? I believe, Brad, you mentioned that the way that Vintage is structured is that you have sort of a master fund and sub LPs or LLCs for specific projects, correct?
Yes. And once again, I recommend, unless you have a lot of money that's getting allocated to a bunch of deals over time and you feel like you have the expertise and the skill and the willingness to do the analysis to invest in a bunch of individual deals, I always recommend funds, whether or not this is mobile home parks or apartments or self-storage or industrial, because I think most people got in trouble during the last cycle when they said, okay, I have $250,000 that I want to allocate to real estate. And they put it into one deal. Like that to me is not proper portfolio diversification. You want your real estate allocation to be spread out ideally over a couple different strategies and certainly a lot of properties. So anyways, that's just kind of how I think about the risk reward, you know, on funds versus individual deals for investors.
When increasing the mobile home park lot rents, do you use market rents for traditional apartments as guides? And if so, what percentage is the lot rent typically in comparison to apartment rents?
Yeah, there's no hard and fast rule. Everybody, you know, it would be great if this industry was a formula. But look, if you just need a rough sense of looking at a deal and feeling out if there's some potential there, 50% of a 3-bedroom apartment rent is a pretty good, hey, we can definitely go to there. You oftentimes can go higher, but that's a decent metric as just a back of the envelope analysis. Obviously, you'd want to go visit the market and figure out exactly what each property and competitive option is for your prospective tenants. But that's a decent metric. And yes, we do look at heavily apartments and single family home rents. The total all-in cost, if you were to buy a home outright, and what that your mortgage payment and maintenance and property taxes would be for a stick-built home versus a mobile home. Because the reality is that your competition in most of the markets that we like to invest in is not other mobile home parks. Because most of the time, those other mobile home parks are pretty full. They're 95% plus occupied. So oftentimes, you're really competing with other housing options, apartment buildings, or, you know, let's be honest. Like given the choice, if the two pricing... If a stick-built home was the same cost as a mobile home all in, the stick-built home is going to win. So we need to make sure that that has an ample margin, right? A big cushion relative to us. And so that's kind of how we think about competition is sizing it to the other housing options in that market. You know, we certainly look at other mobile home parks and see what their lot rent is as just a comparison. But the real game is played at 3-bedroom apartment rents and stick-built home all-in housing costs, in my view.
Next question. What is the likelihood of requiring an additional investment beyond the initial investment?
In our funds, we have never called capital. It's not to say we will never, ever call capital in the future. I have no idea what's going to happen in the future. But I've been doing this 12 years, and any fund that I've ever been a part of in this space has never made a capital call, and has never missed a distribution payment. So I think that's a function of, I'd like to think there's a decent amount of skill in there, but it's also heavily just we picked the right asset class, I think. We diversified sufficiently across markets, across strategy. So not all of the deals are complete hairy value adds, right? We sprinkle in some hairier deals like the Raleigh deal, and we do a fair amount of stabilized deals that are already generating cash flow year one. It also has to do with the fact that going back to just picking the right asset class, picking the right game, these things don't require, giant capital surprises, right? The facade of the building doesn't fall apart. There's no boiler room, there's no lobby remodel, there's no roof repair. So if you do get a surprise, it tends to be range bound on the capital side. Like, okay, if you're going to redo the roads, it's a couple hundred thousand dollars. It's never going to be 5 million, which I've seen those capital bills pop up in other asset classes due to something that you unforeseen, you didn't have in your underwriting. What else can I say about that? Yeah, I think it's also not using floating rate debt. We just didn't get into that game, and I was kicking myself at times. Watching people, generate these insane returns in, 2016 through 21. But I wanted to sleep at night. I just kind of came from a background of institutional real estate where, you didn't really do that much in asset classes that you thought were, where you wanted to generate a lot of cash flow. You'd rather just, hey, take away that interest rate risk. And that's what we did. And so we didn't take on a lot of floating rate debt. And so we didn't have to have capital calls for loan caps or for refinances. And so that was part of it. And that's still the case today. The portfolio for a current fund, doesn't have any floating debt. So we certainly prefer to do fixed rate debt. And that's what we almost always do. But we will do interest only, which I think is really compelling for most real estate deals, is to do an interest-only deal where you have a clear path to value add. There's not real much point in paying principal out of a loan payment when you can use that capital more productively to compound capital versus just paying down your loan. So we do that, but then we go to refinance, and then once the deal is stabilized, then we oftentimes will put it into a full, amortized loan, because hopefully someday those loans are just completely gone. If we've already refinanced a few times out of it. So anyways, that's my thought on capital calls.
All right. So moving on from there, the next question is about the realistic approximate return on investment. For that type of discussion, I would ask that you actually go ahead and just send a quick email to Brad after the Q&A session to talk about that sort of thing. We will need to move on from that. The question after that, again, talks about requiring capital calls beyond the initial investment. I think Brad has addressed that pretty thoroughly in his previous answer just now. Then the next question that is asked, what are your current deal size and where are they?
They're pretty spread out. I'm a big believer, as we talked about, I think I'm beating a dead horse here, but diversification, right? I don't want to be tied to one market 100% or one city, right? So we're spread out, but we tend to prefer red states. And that is a function of regulation. I will never own or invest in anything real estate related in New York. That market is extremely difficult to be a landlord, as I think everybody's kind of aware of from the headlines. And that's not even a political statement. It's just fact. It's just very difficult. They're not very friendly to the real estate business. So we tend to focus on states that are higher growth and have a friendly regulatory environment. It's not to say that we won't do deals in the Pacific Northwest. I frankly think that's pretty good opportunity there because pricing is reset a little bit because there has been new regulations on rent control. And so it's removed a little bit of the doubt about what's going to happen. So now we can actually underwrite it. And so the returns are still compelling. And you've basically just guaranteed that we're going to be able to raise, you know, lot rents up into the max that the regulations will allow every year, because there will never be a new development. The math will not work under those regulations. Just flat out, you know, it doesn't tie. The math doesn't math. And so, yeah, we prefer, you know, I would say kind of the big smile, right? It's like, we will go up to Montana. Like, we love the deals we can find in the Montana mountain states. They are fewer and far between because there's just fewer parks there. We don't do as many deals in the Midwest. But it's not to say that we won't, it's just that there's fewer deals that are in compelling population growing markets that come across our desk. Part of that's just network, I'm sure. But yeah, in the Midwest, you just got to be careful about making sure that, you know, you're still getting increasing population, job growth. And then if we do go to the Midwest, we tend to go for higher quality infrastructure. We want to be like the best park or at least top three in those cities, because you don't get bailed out by, you know, population growth if you do happen to make some sort of due diligence mistake. So that's how we think about location.
The next question, not really a question, harking back to other questions that were asked. I realize 401k IRA doesn't get depreciation, referring to non-qualified monies. I believe we covered that about other folks using, you know, 1031 funds to invest in Brad's and in Vintage or in other things like this. And Brad, I believe, had mentioned that doesn't typically pan out, but can.
Sorry, Jake, what's that question again? What, a 1031?
So they were asking, it was a statement saying that they, you know, realized that depreciation doesn't apply to tax-deferred retirement account monies. They were asking about non-qualified, you know, personal funds. This sort of thing.
Yeah, personal funds, it's great. It becomes the lazy 1031 in that you can, instead of having to go through a full exchange if you're selling something, you can often just make an investment into a property type that has bonus depreciation, like manufactured housing, where oftentimes it's $1 in and $1 in losses the first year. So you make a $100,000 investment, oftentimes you get a $100,000 loss, sometimes even higher in some of our deals based on kind of what the land value is in that market. And that goes back to, once again, we are owning infrastructure. Infrastructure is 15-year property. 15-year property, you can accelerate to the first year. Whereas an apartment building is 27 and a half, a commercial property is 39 years. You can't bonus depreciate that. So yeah, it tends to be fairly compelling from a tax standpoint if that's a motivator. And you can use the losses. Not everybody can use the losses, right? If they're W-2, you know, and that's the only type of income, ordinary income they have, you can't use bonus depreciation losses to offset W-2 income, but you can if it's a real estate, you know, income, other passive income that you have that you're offsetting with this passive investment.
But here's an interesting one. This may be more of a question for Entrust itself, but what if after 2 years I want to leave this fund? How do I exit? That actually mostly will be determined Brad will give the relevant information on that. From the Entrust Group standpoint, exiting an investment involves you, the client, speaking with the party that you've invested with and working out return of funds to your IRA account, under what circumstances those funds are returned by the investment party to your IRA. Is not really ours to comment on. That's a discussion between you, the client, and the party that you're investing with. And as far as the Entrust Group is concerned, that's simply a matter of filling out some pretty basic paperwork for us so that we can accept that money back into your IRA. But I believe Brad has given a little bit more information, if you'd just like to refresh us on that, about the exit from Vintage.
Yeah. So I want to be clear that we have done this with a ton of investors over the years. However, these are not liquid investments, right? The money comes in and it gets deployed into real estate. And so I think that there's some sponsors, especially larger Wall Street firms that market these they call them semi-liquid vehicles. They're not semi-liquid. They're very illiquid. It's just they have created a mechanism to try to allow for these exceptions when they can. And that's how every fund or every investment in real estate works. There might be some sponsors that tell you, oh yeah, sure, we'll send your money right back. Right? No, unless they have cash sitting in the bank account, they can't just sell all of their properties immediately. You have to be able to take care of the existing investors, right? Take care of current needs of the properties. And then you keep a little bit of a liquidity sleeve in cash or treasuries in order to make those kind of payoffs for people that just have something that pops up. But obviously, if there was a run on the bank, you can't honor everybody unless you fire sell the whole portfolio. So I always just like to be very clear with people. Like this goes into your bucket of your illiquid part of your portfolio, which means you should have cash, you should have treasuries, you should have stocks in the other part of your portfolio, right? And the reason why you would do this is because you want better return streams that are non-correlated to the stock market. Otherwise, if you're very concerned with liquidity, like I highly suggest, keep it in treasuries, keep it in public liquid trade that day securities. So this is adding an element to a portfolio, which is generally what we all want with our retirement accounts. We want to reduce the overall volatility and diversify the return streams. But this is going to be your part of your illiquid bucket. We try to honor just about it. Every request that comes in, we make a concerted effort to try to get that person liquidity. But once again, run on the bank, it's not possible. So I just want to be very upfront with that to make sure that people know that about when they're investing in private markets, because I think there's some, snake oil salesman that will tell you, oh yeah, sure. But that's the reality of what's happening, is that these deals are going money into the ground into private assets that, try to sell your house in a day. It doesn't happen. You have to kind of do it over time. And so then if for whatever reason, if we had half of the fund come to us at one given time, because there was some, crisis, the stock market, went down 80%, and everybody's panicking, then there would be a queue, right? And so then we would have to start methodically selling and refinancing assets in order to pay people over time, which is just how every other private fund would have to do it in the same manner.
Excellent response, Brad. So now moving on, there's a few items here. Thanks, Entrust, for hosting. You're very welcome. Glad to have you here. Thank you. Appreciate all of you expressing appreciation. Glad to give information to our clients. We have a few questions here. Minimum investment and returns for MHP. Again, for returns, please feel free to reach out to Brad after the Q&A session, just on a private basis, to talk about returns on investments for his fund or possible returns for other funds. And for information about minimum and maximum investments for vintage, please feel free to reach out to Brad directly about that. Here's some terminology that I'm not quite familiar with, Brad. It says, somebody asked, will you be doing cost seg, SEG? Yeah. Does that mean anything to you?
Yeah, that's a cost segregation study, and that is tied to depreciation. So in order to get this bonus depreciation in that first year, you pay an engineer, a professional firm that does an accounting, that does a report on the asset class, and they give you an itemized schedule report on the valuation of each component of your real estate property, right? You got this much of 15-year property, this much of 5-year property, which is personal property, and this much of every other type of depreciation bucket. And that then allows you to give that to your CPA. They're able to do the math on how much of that investment can be depreciated that first year and accelerated. And if you just think about, what is the IRS trying to accomplish here? Why does the government even allow this? Well, it's an incentive, right? They are trying to boost investment. So we can make new personal property investments, and we can make new infrastructure improvements, productive investments that increase, either expand a park, improve the existing asset that allows more tenants to come in. So we're creating more assets that are generating other tax revenue, right, by making these investments. And as a bonus, the IRS allows us to then take that loss that first year, so benefit from the time value of money. And then if you're keeping these things indefinitely, right, then you really get to benefit from the time value of money in that depreciation benefit versus the people that will flip a park, I don't really understand why you would want to flip something that is so finite in nature. There's only maybe 10,000 of these things that you might want to own. There's probably 48,000 total. So it's harder to buy these things than it is, say, an apartment building. So when you get one, that's a good deal. Oftentimes it can take 5 years to try to convince the seller to actually sell the deal to you. So you don't want to sell it in 2 years and get just a great IRR and a great return, but you know, you've lost out on decades of possible cash flow and compounding. So we dramatically prefer to hold it long-term, and therefore you're not having to pay that depreciation recapture. So if you bonus depreciate that first year and sell in year three, you still pay for that money back to the IRS. It's just, you know, you got a 3 year time value of money on that deduction. Whereas if you hold it for 10 plus year, then the time value of money on that deduction is quite high.
We have more questions. Minimum or maximum levels of investment vintage has for this type of investment. Another question to be asked to Brad directly. You can see his contact information there on screen. What is the average ratio of mobile home with acreage of land? So like the home to lot ratio is what they're asking there, Brad.
Yeah. So I would, if I had to guess, we haven't done this math in a long time, but if I had to guess, it's probably 6.5, between 6 and 7 homes per acre. The really dense parks, 10 homes per acre, they're stacked on top of each other. There's no space in between the homes. You see this in infill locations, right? In the middle of a fairly big city, you will see this just because the land value is so disproportionately high. You can't have those things spaced out because the parks that were really spaced, you know, had a lot of space in an amazing location like that were long ago sold off to a housing developer, to somebody that went vertical with an apartment, to a shopping developer, because it just didn't make sense to have that few homes, mobile homes, take up that much land space. So the only ones that are existing in infill locations are like on top of each other. Whereas we, you know, it's harder to find those deals. We're not buying a lot of deals in Orange County, California, right? Where I'm at today. They don't sell that often. And, you know, they're extremely expensive. They don't generate a ton of cash flow. And they never trade because the sellers, the owners know what an amazing asset they have. So we're buying oftentimes in a place like Raleigh, where you saw a picture of those homes. They're quite spread out. Even the Montana deal, those homes, you know, there's quite a bit of space in between them. So when they are really tight, like 10-to-1, you just got to be extra careful about regulations, extra careful about infrastructure repairs, because you know there's just not a lot of room to operate. You don't want to do any septic deals in a market like that, because what happens if one fails? You know, the leach field, you can't replace a new one, you can't put a new one in, and all of a sudden you have a major problem. So we tend to discourage people from going to infill locations unless they really know what they're doing, because you're going to have to pay a pretty high price to even get into that game. So you just want to make sure that you're a seasoned vet at that point.
Okay, so it's like a couple of these coming up are the same sort of things of asking about investment levels. We're going to skip through those. One thing I will touch on here, somebody asked about, do investors with vintage have to be accredited investors? Is that something that is relevant to your model there, Brad?
Yes, it is. That's the regulation that we and the overwhelming majority of everybody in our space it focuses on. It's kind of an unfortunate thing. I do think the SEC is making moves to reduce the restrictions on private assets. And I think next year we'll actually see a few asset classes that will be enabled to go non-accredited, but we're not there yet.
So moving on then, is this a limited partnership structure? Is it an allowable investment vehicle for a self-directed IRA? And to speak on that last bit, yes, limited partnerships as well as LLCs, joint ventures, and other private equity structures are very much allowed in as assets you can purchase using a self-directed IRAs. Limited partnerships, certainly, many of our clients make that make investments in that sort of private equity structure. I don't be I believe you've answered this question already, though, Brad. That this is not a
LLC.
limited partnership, though. It's an LLC, typically, is how you structure your funds.
Yeah, it's an LLC because that way the investors are capped, their liabilities capped to the amount invested. They're not a, you know, they're not a partner and with unlimited liability, which you see a lot of oil and gas funds will be structured that way. But yeah, it's an LLC.
Okay, a multi-part question here. So let's break this down. In parks with lots of park-owned homes, how do you value these fully depreciated homes? If occupied, what percentage of the sales are to the existing renters? If not, are you waiting for the tenant to vacate before trying to sell it? Lastly, in general terms, how are you valuing the price of a single pad?
So that was a very detailed question. That was somebody knows their stuff. Mm-hmm. So the first part of that question is how do you value the homes? The danger is to just put a cap rate or a multiple on the income stream from the rental, because you have your lot rent payment, right? That could be $500. And then you would have a home rent payment. You want those to be two checks, ideally. So you can spread out, you know, you can split out the revenue and account for things appropriately. So the home rent, you generally don't want to put the same multiple or cap rate on the home rent as you do on the lot rent, because this thing is extremely valuable. This stream of income is not that valuable, right? Because there's a lot of maintenance and hassles in the home business that we don't want to be in ultimately. But it's a tool. It's a means to an end to fill a park or to buy a park that we can come in with our team and value add business plan to generate great returns. So what you want to do is try to figure out, if I tried to sell that home on the open market by itself, what would it be worth? Right? Because then you can get a true value of what that asset is that you're paying for, and not put an elevated multiple on the income stream from that home. Because then you oftentimes, if you do that, right? Because the home rent payment oftentimes is not that variable with the quality of the home. Right? If you're doing a rental, you're going to get a $500 home payment on a 1990 single wide, and maybe the double wide brand new is only a couple hundred dollars more, right? So it's not dramatically different. And yet that double wide is extremely valuable if it's new, and that extremely old single wide might be worthless, right? That might actually be a negative asset on your balance sheet if you decide that you need to demo it and get it off the property to put it in a brand nice new looking home. There is a weird quirk in some markets where the homes are actually appreciating. And you can think of that as the extreme example of that is Malibu, right? So gorgeous Malibu has a couple of parks. Tragically, obviously, you know, one of them burned down with the last fires, which is horrible. But the ones that did not, that are still there, oftentimes you see these homes, a mobile home, a fixed up, you know, 1985 single wide or double is worth $3 million because it's in Malibu and it has the right to be there and it's got a gorgeous view of the ocean. And why is that? Well, the value is accruing disproportionately to the homeowner versus the landowner because rents are capped. So you can't, there's rent control. And so in markets that are fully caught up to in lot rent, where kind of everybody's around market and or there's some regulation capping the upside, then you start to see the homes appreciate in value, which is actually a great thing. We want that long term in most of our markets, because that's more skin in the game that the tenants have. The more that they are invested in that community, the better they're going to take care of their home, the more they're going to, you know, invest in the community and friendships and relationships, because they see themselves being there long term. The more they're going to, you know, just make sure they don't, you know, miss a monthly lot rent payment because they have this amazing asset that keeps appreciating. So that was a long-winded answer to your first question. The point on when like the Raleigh Park, where there's 100 park-owned homes that we want off the balance sheet, at least 80% of those we would like off the balance sheet, right? 20%. We can still get just as many options to finance those with Fannie Mae, but Fannie Mae tends to not want more than 25, 30%. So we have a little bit of margin in error if we get to 20. So the idea there is, yes, you go to the existing renter and you give them a deal of a lifetime, right? You make them not put anything down or just a little bit down for a down payment. And you actually put the title in their name, but now they have to take over the maintenance of it, right? And they have to, you know, you make a deal with them that they're not missing lot rent payments, right? Because you just gave them this asset. And so oftentimes we will try to not pay too much on the purchase price or not assign a lot of value to the homes because we want to fire sell them, or at least give a big discount on them when we try to go ahead and sell them to a new or existing tenant. I think that was the bulk of his questions, but correct me if I'm wrong.
Mm-hmm. I believe we've touched on all of the major assets there, but Mr. Fawn, if you have further questions that you'd like addressed, please feel free to reach out to Brad or myself afterwards for further detail. Thank you for your very detailed and well thought out question. A simpler one, are your property managers in each location vintage staff, or do you subcontract that work out?
Yeah, so we typically partner with groups regionally that are dealing with the property management teams. And that's because we want to spread out. We want to be as diversified as possible. We want local teams, and we want to see a lot of deal flow. Because I think the hard part about this business is that you can't just put $500 million to work reliably, or even $100 million to work, or even 20, right, real quickly, because there's just not that many of these opportunities. There's a lot fewer parks, as we mentioned. So we want to see a lot of deal flow from our partners and not just have our own team out there finding these deals. And so oftentimes some of our partners will only see one or two deals a year. Well, we want to see 20, 30 deals a year. So we like to have regional partnerships in order to have direct oversight. Because, you know, the team just can't be flying all over the country and see these assets enough as we'd like. So we want to have boots on the ground in each of the regional markets. As far as the property management is not third party, though. That is tougher in this world. You generally don't get the ability to just hire a third party manager and pay them as a vendor in this space like you can in other asset classes. Like apartment buildings, generally speaking, you can go to any major market and there's 20 different options for a property management team that you could hire. That's not the case in this world. There's a handful and they're nationwide. So it's not like they have a presence in every market. And so if you have a deal and they're not in that market, that would be a first asset for them in that market. And they're generally good at babysitting deals. They're not as good as value add deals because if you can imagine it, it's like their business is, you know, their profit margins are much thinner. And so they can't just fly out a ton of team members there, and they're not incentivized. They're not part of the team, the ownership team. So we have to have first party property management infrastructure in place in all of our deals that's controlled by the ownership group.
Do the states you invest in have a provision for residents to form co-ops and preempt your offer?
Preempt our offer? No. Now, there might be one state that I'm missing, but the vast majority of them, we're not in those states. Those are the states, the blue states in the Northeast. It's fairly common for them to be, it's called a right of first refusal. So if you go to sell your park, you have to notify the tenant base. They can form a co-op to match that offer and buy the park themselves. That is very common in the Northeast, which is not where we own anything currently because of what we've already talked about. Now, it's not a bad thing, though. It's nice when the tenants can purchase their own property if they have, you know, they can pull together those resources and get organized. It's kind of funny though, because oftentimes they end up having to, it's like they might have complained about prior lot rent increases. But when they actually become the ownership groups, it's like they realize, well, in order to keep maintaining the park, we're going to have to implement lot rent increases on ourselves. Otherwise, we don't have any reserves to fix the property. So generally speaking, I think it's a great thing when that does happen. But yeah, it does create a slight constraint if you are the owner of that property in that state that has that requirement, because you can't then just sell when you want to, right? Quickly to the group that has made the highest offer. You have to go through a process. And sometimes it's quite a lengthy process. You got to give the tenant group maybe 90 days to match that offer. And, you know, there's a saying in real estate, time kills deals. So once you get, you know, a process, you have a marketed brokered process, you get a bunch of bids, you pick a winner, you want to start that due diligence and closing process. You don't want to just sit and pause for 90 days because deals can get stale. Interest rates can fluctuate. Things can happen.
Okay. Then we have a few more questions of a type that we've had to skip over. What has been the average ROI for the last 5 years, 10? What is the minimum hold period when you intend to refinance? Those sorts of things. Again, please reach out directly to Brad for specifics on return or investment terms and things of that nature. After the Q&A session, you can reach out to him directly. Again, his information and mine, if you have more logistical concerns or questions about IRA specifically, are on the screen. Brad, how are your team members vetted? What types of background investigations and how often, asks one of our viewers.
Yeah, so it's a case-by-case basis. It's the, because we're working with partners in each of these markets. And, you know, we are relying on them to do a lot of the vetting of the staff, on-site staff. So yeah, the background checks are just kind of at, you know, when you hire an employee, will you run a background check? And we're not doing it on an ongoing basis. Now, it's been a long time, but yeah, 6 years ago, I think we had an employee issue at one of the properties with some theft. And because, as you can imagine, back then it was actually even harder to collect everything digital. Now there's all kinds of systems in place that don't allow cash deposits. But back then, when, you know, it was quite tempting for, you know, somebody that might be living in a mobile home park to be collecting tens of thousands of dollars in cash. And if something pops up in their life, that, you know, that was a risk. But we quickly moved towards, you know, all digital payments. And that's true for all the assets at this point. So yeah, I think every company deals with you can't be running background checks on your staff every 3 months, right? So you do it at the beginning. You try to make your best estimate on who you're hiring. You fire fast if there's a problem. You hire slow, and you try to align incentives and pay people well. And so good things happen when you get those incentives in place.
Here's one for me to tackle. How does Entrust handle monthly income to their account? To an account, is there a charge? And the answer to that is that it depends. If there are any sort of fees associated with a deposit of income from an asset like a mobile home park fund or anything else, the Entrust Group charges a fee based on how the money is deposited into your account because of how we receive that money through our bank. So if you have a check sent to the Entrust Group or an ACH deposit, there is no fee for depositing money into your account from your investments. It's just income deposits from your investments. There's no fee involved with an ACH deposit or a check being sent to us for deposit. There is a fee for a wire deposit. So if you have, payments coming into your Entrust Group IRA from as a wire deposit, there is a $30 fee that is charged to us by our bank because the bank costs money to receive a wire transfer at a bank. We get charged by the bank and that cost is passed on to our clients. So there's a $30 charge for a wire deposit of income from your investment. If you have that sent by wire, no fee otherwise. And then Brad, what's your take on these investments with the possible reorganization of Fannie and Freddie for demand of these types of mobile home properties going forward?
If Fannie and Freddie love these asset classes, I don't have a hot take on what the future is for Fannie and Freddie, given the government involvement or not. I mean, they're de facto government agencies. I have been for a long time. The reality is that the housing market is subsidized by the government, right? They're in a open market. We would not have interest rates for a 30-year loan at the current rate that they are. Who is buying that product? Who is investing at those loan rates when anybody can refinance at any time? So Fannie and Freddie are subsidized, right? It's just a fact. They love this asset class because of all the things we talked about on the stability, right? They don't want to see any defaults. They don't want to deal with real estate owned on their books, which happens when a lender, you know, stops paying. And you could imagine, you know, it's a fraction of the size of the apartment market. So they have a mandate to push more and more into affordable housing, and manufactured housing is a big part of that component for them. And so it's part of their mandate. They're supposed to be allocating more and more of their funds to this sector. They love it from a risk standpoint, and are the largest lender in the space. And we're excited about them adding more liquidity to the asset class. Sorry, Jake, just a note, I got to bounce in 4 minutes here. So maybe one more question.
Okay. I was going to bring that up at 1 o'clock. So thank you for flagging that, Brad.
Yeah. No
problem. We do have about 15 more questions here. So we probably won't be able to return to get to all of those. Thank you all for your very compelling engagement on this topic. We thank you for helping us to get so much engagement here. I have enjoyed talking about this topic, but one thing that I'd like to just go ahead and answer while we still have time, somebody asked, does a distribution from the fund equate to a distribution from the IOA and is taxed as OI? So that I would like to clarify that no, income from an investment that you've made through your Entrust Group IRA that comes back to your Entrust Group IRA is not, you know, that's not a distribution in the way that is relevant for retirement accounts. A distribution, as in a deposit of income from your investment to your IRA, is not a distribution as in a removal of funds or value from your IRA, and thus a removal of funds or value from the tax sheltered, you know, the tax protections of an IRA, which means that your money becomes taxable. So no, money that is deposited back into your IRA from vintage or any other investment as a distribution or income deposit, to make things clear, is not a taxable distribution from your IRA. And to tackle perhaps one more thing for you, Brad, are your investments structured to avoid UDFI and the associated tax?
No, we do not create a blocker company to do that. I know that is, you know, that is one of the bummer parts about investing through an IRA is that the financing component, it does generate not UBIT, but UDFI, I think is the term. So yeah, that is a component. The nice thing is that part of the other variables of the accounting of the depreciation, even though you're not getting the benefit of the depreciation, my understanding is that you get some of that benefit in terms of offsetting some of that UDFI. But I would talk to your accountant. We've had a ton of retirement account investors over the years, and I think most of them would agree that the benefits have outweighed kind of the small impact that there has been on the UDFI front.
All right. So thank you very much, Brad and Ian, for your information today. This has been a very an incredibly engaged discussion that we've had, and I hope that you who have attended have found this as helpful and enlightening as we can make it. For those of you, dozen or so of you whose questions were not answered, very sorry to have to cut this short, but please feel free to send either Brad or myself direct follow-ups if you have further questions that you would like answered on this topic. We are glad to provide further information. So Brad, I will let you go. Thank you for lending your expertise to our discussion today.
Yeah, no, thank you, Jake, and certainly thank you to the Entrust Group. We've had a fair amount of investors over the years that have used you guys as a custodian and have always said great things And so, yeah, I just wanted to thank you guys for the time today, both you, Jake, your team, and the people, of course, listening at home and at work. All right. Well, thanks, everybody. And feel free to reach out. I think, yeah, our website, vintage-funds.com, and click on the track record to get that info. It's probably the most applicable to evaluating, I think, any operator. So thanks for the time.
Have a good day, folks.